The following is presented as an entertainment program emphasizing folklore. It is not intended as legal or medical advice in any way and should not be used to replace the advice of a legal or medical professional. Hello and welcome to the New World Witchery Folk Magician's Notebook episode for August 2026. These are short monthly episodes that will offer a brief overview of folk magical topics and information that might be useful to you over the coming month. We highly recommend that you also pick up a reliable almanac for folk magic such as the Witch's Almanac, Llewellyn's Astrological Pocket Planner, the Ritual Daily Planner, or your local Farmer's Almanac. Let's take a look at the moon for August 2026. On August 1st, it's Lunasa, or Lammas, a good day to bake some bread and celebrate the first harvest, or if you're a constant gardener, likely the dozenth harvest, but still a good time to celebrate. The moon will be waning in Pisces, so leave your below-ground crops alone for the moment, no potato bread or carrot cake this time, but enjoy anything made with sprouted grains or above-ground crops like oats, wheat, or barley. We continue the waning cycle on the 2nd and 3rd in Aries, and in the 4th through 5th on Taurus. You may feel a need to do some magic just to get your energy moving, which is not a problem so long as you lean into the grounded, familiar magic, and don't try anything too wild or new these days. Your intuition may be a bit wonky as well, so practice what you know and try to get better at the tried and true spells on these days. On the 6th, the moon is void, of course, which will be a good recharge day for rest and maybe reading up on magical history and lore. The 7th and 8th have the moon waning in Gemini, which may have your intellect feeling neglected, so engage in things that challenge you. This is a time to learn some new spells or try your hand at puzzles, magical or mundane, that have been eluding you. The 9th through 10th see the moon waning in Cancer, and also have a beautiful alignment of planets in the sky. If you look in the morning, you'll see the last hint of a waning crescent moon, along with Jupiter, Mercury, and Mars at the sky. And it's a good time to draw on the influences of those planets for talismans and sigil craft. On the 11th through 12th, the moon is in Leo, where it will be for a new moon on the 12th. This may have you feeling a need to be bold and generous with your magical time and energy, so craft some magical gifts if you like, and give them away. There's also the Perseid meteor shower peaking on the 12th and 13th, and a solar eclipse will be visible in parts of the northern hemisphere on the 12th, most likely in places like Greenland and Iceland, although you may see some dimming in North America too, depending on where you are. We are waxing again on the 13th and 14th in Virgo, and if you want to get that back-to-school energy going, this is a great time for that. Draw up your magical syllabus and plan out your next few months of magical learning and practice. On the 15th and 16th, the moon is in Libra, then on the 17th and 18th, in Scorpio, which will likely give you some energy for follow-through, and if you can check off your boxes as you begin your magical learning, you'll be feeding your mysterious and curious Scorpio energy very well. The moon is void, of course, again on the 19th, so let yourself have a day off to recharge. Then you can dive back in with renewed vigor on the 20th and 21st when the moon waxes in Sagittarius. You can bring covenmates and friends in on your plans here and possibly see if you can get an accountability partner or two in your magical development. That will feel extra good if you've done it by the 22nd through the 24th, when the moon is in Capricorn, and you want to see that your magic has started to grow roots and feels grounded in real, practical plans. On the 25th through the 26th, the moon's in Aquarius, then in Pisces on the 27th and 28th. These will be good days to let your imagination and creativity shine, and to consider some experimentation with your magical work. You've also got a lunar eclipse coming in with the full Sturgeon moon on the 27th, so it may feel like an especially potent time to explore work with the underworld or the darker side of your witchcraft. Finally, we end the month with a just waning moon in Aries on the 29th through 31st, which may again have you feeling a little bit of pent-up energy and feeling ready to do things. But like the beginning of the month, it's best to dig into the magic you've already started working with, rather than launch new things. But don't give up on your magical studies. This old professor believes in you. In the cards. Each month, I'll pull a card each from the tarot and playing card decks and indicate the meanings of those cards in general and offer my own interpretations of how they could be read in actual practice. Our playing card of the month is the Four of Hearts. This card represents a trunk or a travel case or something that is locked. That may seem strange for a heart card, but since you have four hearts, one in each corner, there's a sort of stasis as each pulls equally in opposite directions, and the balanced static nature of the card makes sense. This is a feeling of being secure, even in uncertain times, but also emotionally closed off. That might have to do with protecting your peace or just doing the work you need to do internally to deal with something difficult or traumatic. But it can also indicate that you're feeling boxed in and unable to make progress in your emotional life, if matched with an Ace of Clubs, perhaps, or your romantic and or sexual life, if paired with the Two of Hearts, for example. If that's the case, the card may be asking you to open up and be vulnerable in order to break out of your pattern. After all, what good is a packed suitcase if you aren't going anywhere? The Tarot card of the month is the Seven of Pentacles. This card is the Tortoise and Hare card, asking you to take a big picture of you and remember that slow and steady wins the race. In the traditional Rider-Waite-Smith deck, it shows a gardener or farmer standing by a productive pentacle bush, which has fruited and produced much, so much that a pentacle sits at the farmer's feet while they lean on their hoe. The farmer just watches the bush, waiting for the right moment to begin a harvest, indicating the need for long-term planning and forethought. A sense of not grasping at things in the here and now, but keeping a future-oriented perspective. Paired with something like the King of Pentacles or a Nine of Cups, it could be saying that your long-term plans are coming to fruition, and all you need is a bit of patience to get there. Our folk divination method of the month, turning the loaf. Since August is a good month to bake bread and put up preserves, I thought it would be fun to share a folk divination technique that has been used by cunning folk in England for over 600 years. This method is called turning the loaf and involves a few very simple tools: a loaf of bread, four knives, and a peg or something to balance the loaf on. The basic method involves putting a knife into the loaf in each of the four cardinal directions to form a sort of cross with the loaf as the center. The loaf is then pushed onto a peg or balanced on a similar object and asked questions. When the answer to the question is a yes, the loaf will begin to rotate or fall off the peg. Traditionally, this was used to identify thieves and other criminals by naming suspects one by one until the loaf moved, but it has also been repurposed for other forms of divination as well, such as asking about future love matches. The knives used for this divination method can be simple butter knives or any other kitchen knives, and the peg could be something as simple as the wooden handle of a spoon. Ideally, this method is done in the presence of other people who will take turns naming their suspects, crushes, or asking questions, with the cunning person simply holding the peg while the loaf is suspended or rotates, as the case may be. A whole loaf is traditionally used, but who knows, maybe you'd have luck with a particularly thick slice of Texas toast and a set of steak knives. A slightly different version of turning the loaf is recorded by Ozark folklorist Vance Randolph. He mentions that those looking for the body of someone drowned will go out onto the water and float a loaf of bread, then will watch for it to turn around three times over the same spot, which indicates where the person can be found. A similar version of this is found in northern England, where the bread would have a hole put into it that was filled with a bit of liquid mercury, then placed on the water, where it would sail straight for the missing corpse. So if you're doing some baking this late summer season, enjoy your carbs, and maybe keep an extra loaf on hand, just in case someone pilfers your preserves. A Witch's Words. The Witch's Proverb of the Month. To practice magic is to bear the responsibility for having a vision. Starhawk. Our folktale of the month, Sop Doll Sop, a traditional folktale of the Blue Ridge Mountains. There was a poor little orphan boy growing up in the country, and his name was Jack, and he never could find anything he could do. So he found an advertisement of a man who wanted a miller. He tramped across the mountain and went a long ways till he come to the miller's house. Got there one Sunday afternoon. In those days, they didn't ever come up to the house and ring the doorbell. They always just hollered, "Hello." So Jack hollered, "Hello." Miller says, "What'll you have?" "Well, I've seen your advertisement," said Jack. "I've come to work for you." "Well, I'm in need of a miller." "Well, but Dad, I've come to tend your mill for you." "Well, I'll just tell you, I've hired lots of millers, but they always died," said the miller. Well, I'd just as soon be dead as alive. I've got no home, no place to stay, says Jack. Well, you're the kind of man I'm looking for, says the miller. We'll go down and I'll show you around the mill. Now, you'll have to cook here on this fireplace. Here's your meal and your meat and your skillet. Just make yourself at home, cook what you need. Well, but Dad, I'll get along all right, says Jack. And Jack baked him some bread, made him some coffee, and fried him up some meat. He didn't put his meat and bread up on the table, just put them on the floor and sat down beside him. He had a little brass lamp in the light of the fireplace, and the moon was shining as bright as daylight. All at once, the little cabin got as dark as midnight. He got up, jarred up his fire, and when he looked around in every crack in the house, it was full of cats, just as thick as they can cut a stick, with their eyes just shining. That sort of scared him. And he just sat down and commenced to eating. All of a sudden, one big old black cat jumped out of the middle and hollered up, "Sup, doll, sup!" Then all the cats sat down on the floor. That black cat walked up and propped a paw in the meat sop and licked it and hollered, "Sup, doll, sup!" He began to get scared and he said, "Stick your old paw in here again and I'll whack it off." So the cat stuck it in and hollered, "Sup, doll, sup!" "You do it again," says Jack. "I'll hack it off." Well, he did it again, and off it he hacked. When he hacked at it, it fell off into the frying pan, but it was a woman's hand with a ring on the finger. And the cat hollered, "Wah!" And all the cats went out the cracks, and the moon shined back in as bright as day. So Jack, he took that hand, and he wrapped it up in some tissue paper and dropped it in his coat pocket. The next morning, he was up bright and early, and he had his breakfast over and was grinding and whistling, and the miller came on down. He said, "Well, hello, Jack. I see you're still alive." "Yes, but Dad, I'm still alive," says Jack. "But I'll tell you what I done last night," and he told all about the cats. "Let me show you what I done, too," and he pulled the hand out of his pocket. He handed this over to the old man. The old man said, "That's my wife's hand." Jack says, "Oh, surely not." He says, "Yes, it is." Jack says, "Well, she's a big black cat when I hacked it off." "Well, it is hers," said the miller, "for this is a ring I put on her hand yesterday." He took the hand and went up to the house and said, "Nancy, let's see your right hand." And she poked him at her left. He says, "Nancy, it's your right hands I want." She began to cry and says, "I haven't any." So he says, "Now tell me all about this, Nancy. I won't have you burned." And she said, "Well, I didn't want you to have a miller. I wanted you to keep the mill yourself. So I got all my friends and witched them into cats and got them to witch themselves into cats. And we put poison into the miller's sop. And when I went and put poison in this man's sop, he hacked off my hand." Well, the miller gathered up all the other witches and had them burnt. Well, that made all the other husbands mad, so they had his wife hung. He wouldn't let him burn her because he said that she shouldn't be burned. And thus, Jack made an end of a good many witches. Book Review. Witches, Ghosts, and Signs by Patrick W. Gaynor. Our book review this time isn't particularly new, but it's a trove of Appalachian folklore that I've used frequently in research. Witches, Ghosts, and Signs by Patrick W. Gaynor is a book all about mountain folklore from what Gaynor labels the Southern Appalachians, although it really covers from around the mid-range area of the mountains down to its southern portion, encompassing all of West Virginia and some lore that seems to have circulated from Virginia and North Carolina as well. The material here is divided into a few different categories, including speech, customs, ghost lore, cures, superstitions, and witchcraft, along with a handful of others. The narratives are taken from direct accounts collected by Gaynor in his time as a folklorist and professor at West Virginia University. Gaynor taught at the university for decades and received awards for both his folklore research and his teaching at WVU, and even a state award for his contributions to West Virginia's heritage. In addition to his work as a folklorist and educator, he also played music, which he collected from folk musicians in the area and which was published as a separate book. This book was a legacy work, one that he published based on his years of teaching and recording West Virginia folklore, but which only had a very small initial press run. However, Gaynor's family and the West Virginia University Press re-released it a few years ago under the editorial guidance of one of Gaynor's former colleagues, Judy Priscilla Byers of the Frank and Jane Gabor West Virginia Folklife Center. In it, Gaynor collected many tales that will be familiar, including a version of the Sop Doll Sop story called The Black Cat is Beaten, as well as a wide range of lore relating to farming, weather, folk healing, and beliefs from this cultural region. He also fiercely defended his home and its lore, pushing back against any stereotypes of the hillbilly and insisting that he and those around him were mountaineers instead. The book's lore is categorized according to a motif index at the end, making it useful to anyone engaging with this as a scholarly work and looking to do their own folklore research. But even if you're just looking to explore some West Virginian folktales to, as Gaynor would say, pass the time, this collection will provide dozens of narratives sure to do just that. Materia Magica. Magical knives. I've gotten into the habit of collecting a few good pocket knives. Mostly, these are utilitarian in purpose. I often need to be able to open a box or a letter, for example, and having a handy pen knife or my trusty little open nail knife in my bag is incredibly useful. I also like to keep a little curved blade knife handy for doing magical work like cutting through strings, usually red ones, as I'm tying up a charm bag. A knife can be useful, dangerous, beautiful, and ordinary. And we would be hard-pressed to get much done in our daily lives without things like kitchen knives or utility blades. For our Materia Magica, I thought we could look at a few knives from folklore, as well as some of the folklore about knives that's out there. Some famous knives include Carnwenon, King Arthur's dagger in Welsh folklore, used to slay the witch Ordu; the Purba, a Tibetan and Himalayan spiritual tradition knife that is a three-sided dagger used as a way to overcome or deflect evil or harmful energies and spirits. The Athame. This is the ritual dagger used in many forms of Wicca, which is often black-handled and magnetized. It is used during the casting of circles and ritual invocations, as well as in the Great Rite. The Trollkniv. A Scandinavian folkkiller's knife made from iron, used to cut through or remove spiritual illnesses. The Bolin, a white-handled knife often used for gathering herbs. It is sometimes curved or in the form of a crescent or sickle. The Kris, a wavy-bladed ceremonial dagger used in Javanese folk rituals. The Sekaspita, a Roman ritual knife made from a mixture of brass and copper used for making sacrifices. And the Tanto, the dagger that usually accompanies a katana blade as part of a samurai's gear. These smaller daggers were used for combat sometimes, but also held spiritual significance as they were given as gifts, used to ward off evil, or even employed in the act of ritually taking one's own life to preserve honor, a process known as seppuku. In Foxfire 4, a whole section on knife making discusses two renowned Appalachian knife makers, Troy Danner and Tedra Harmon, who both fashion their blades from steel or metal they reclaim from broken pieces of other items, such as old saw blades or a phonograph spring. While these are not inherently magical, they do tie into folk ways of reusing old items, which has its own sort of magic. Silver knives are often thought to have the power to do extra harm to supernatural creatures, be those werewolves, vampires, witches, or ghosts. Many Appalachian stories feature a silver knife used to cut off the limb from a strange animal, only to find that the limb turns into a human one, and that the person who lost a finger, hand, or arm was a witch animal in disguise, as in the case of the Sotpaw story. Other lore about knives notes that a knife should not be given as a present between friends or lovers, or else they will sever the relationship. Any knife must be bought, even if only for a penny, to prevent that from happening. Scissors and razors also fall under this taboo. This advice goes back at least 500 years and appears in the Distaff Gospels, a collection of women's folklore from France. Some believe that knives should be stowed in drawers during a thunderstorm, or they will attract lightning. Finding a knife is bad luck, especially if it is touched or taken, so it's best just to leave it alone. A becalmed boat can raise some wind if a sailor will jam his penknife into the mast. A knife that falls and lands sticking to the floor by its point presages company coming. Using a knife to stir a drink will only stir up bad tempers and strife among those present. Knives can be used in the turning the loaf divination, which we've already mentioned, but should not be spun at a table or it will land on the person who's to die next. That being said, there is a divination game involving spinning a knife as a sort of spin the bottle way, which the lore seems to go back about as far as the taboo on knife spinning, so I suppose it's really all up to you to decide which you'll take a stab at. Creature Corner. The Pope Lick Monster. If you're heading to Louisville, Kentucky, you will probably want to stop off at the Louisville Slugger Museum. They have a fun little arts district there too, and a famous sandwich with the unappetizing name The Hot Brown, which is actually pretty good. If you wander just outside of town, though, you may bump into the Pope Lick Monster. This creature is said to haunt a trestle railroad bridge over the Pope Lick Creek, and even just its presence in the local folklore has led to some tragic ends. The creature is usually described as humanoid, but partly goat, and some will even throw in a sheep as a portion of the monster's makeup for good measure. Despite sounding like a fawn or a very tall escapee from a petting zoo, the monster's reputation is of a creature that screams and terrorizes anyone who comes near its home on or under the bridge. Various legends account for its origins, ranging from it being an escaped lab experiment to a rogue circus attraction to the product of satanic cults and rituals. Some people say it can imitate the voices of humans it hears, and will use that power to lure their friends or family members to the bridge. Others bypass the vocal trickery in favor of saying the monster uses hypnosis to get people onto the bridge. No matter how they wind up there, the result is that the Pope Lick Monster is trying to kill them by putting them into the path of an oncoming train. Why? The reasoning there is very unclear, but we do know that because of the legends about the monster that sprang up, largely in the 1980s and 90s, many people have tried to find it by going out onto the bridge, imagining that the killer train is sent from hell or another mystical origin. In fact, the bridge is very much used by commercial trains for shipping freight, and the legend tripping, a folklore term for hunting down a cryptid like this with a group or on your own, has led to several deaths of people who got caught in the path of a very real oncoming train. The Pope Lick Monster is also not entirely unique, with goatman-type creatures showing up in states like Texas and West Virginia as well. Many share similar stories and also reside on or near bridges, which may speak to the way that folklore carries core elements that are integrated into new places. Or who knows, maybe there are just more goatmen around than we realize. Instead of a listener email this time, it's less of an email than a thread that's been going around on our Discord server. In our Sabbath Songs subchannel, Arkin Crow mentioned that the cast recording of the Broadway show Hadestown is currently out in movie theaters in honor of its 10th anniversary. Now, if you haven't had a chance to see it, I'd love to recommend that you do. I've seen the show a few different times with a few different casts, and it's the closest thing to having a ritual theater, theatrical ritual, that I've ever experienced outside of specifically magical or pagan environments. It's the story of Orpheus and Eurydice, as well as the myth of Persephone and Hades, and they are intertwined against a Depression-era-style musical score with lots of trombone, jangly piano, and a railroad whistle, and a lot more. It asks you to believe in something, even if you know how it's going to end, and then asks you to do it again, and again, and again, and there is something almost alchemical that has happened when I watched it and felt my relationship with story, narrative, and myth change. So I thought I'd share that with you since it is out in theaters for a bit longer, and you can get the chance to see it with one of the best casts possible for a fraction of the price of a Broadway ticket. It will also be coming to streaming on Apple TV eventually, so if you don't make it out to the movies, I hope that however you find it, you enjoy it. And that will about do it for us this time around on the Folk Magician's Notebook. I hope that you have gotten something useful out of this, and we'd love to hear your thoughts. Anything that you want to share with us, we'd love to hear that. Feel free to drop us a line. You can do that at compassandkey@gmail.com or newworldwitcherypodcast@gmail.com. Both of those will reach us. You can find this show as well as a ton of articles on North American folk magic and all sorts of other stuff at our website, newworldwitchery.com. And you can also go to newworldwitchery.com/find-us to find all of our social media, including your Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, all that kind of stuff. So lots and lots of ways to reach us there, too. So feel free to do that. And if you enjoy the show and if this is useful to you, you're getting something out of this, you would like to maybe join in on that Discord server that I mentioned at the end there, or get some other perks. We have things like zines that come out about once a year, and some other kind of fun things, plus bonus episodes every once in a while, book clubs, all kinds of fun stuff. You know, please feel free to do that by joining our Patreon support group, which is patreon.com/newworldwitchery. $1 a month, whatever you can afford, gets you access to different things. And yeah, we, you know, any support you can give, well, we really appreciate it. And like I said, $1 a month gets you access. It gets you access to the Discord server. It'll get you access to things like the book club, all kinds of stuff. So really, would love to get your support there if you are able to do that. If you can't do that financially, we totally do understand. If you do want to support the show, leave us ratings where you're finding us, whether that's on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever that is. Or, you know, share us around, let folks know about us. That does help to grow the audience and get us support. And yeah, very, very useful. So please feel free to do that. But yeah, that'll about do it for us this time. And have a great August. We'll be back again in September with more Folk Magician's Notebook. But until then, thanks for listening. Be well.